TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. At an Indian wedding in the Trinity Alps, four young men arrived with a gift of freshly caught salmon. Their trucks were covered with dust from the ride down the long dirt road. Stashed between the cooler boxes for the fish were crossbows, tripods, cameras, and camping gear, along with pouches of pine nuts. I was one of the few people there who did not know who they were, and I had to wait to talk to them because they immediately started to work. They carried the salmon over to the fire pit next to the blankets with the gifts for the guests. The way they tended the fire, cut and filleted the salmon, and used tapered redwood spears to hold the fish up to the glowing coals, was a skillful traditional ritual where every gesture counted. Meanwhile, I helped one of the other guests stir the pot of acorn mush and learned that this was also a gift from one of the four young men. Frank Kanawa Lake had collected the acorn, dried, ground, and leached them. I learned that they are a team of Native American graduate students at the University of Oregon, Corvallis. They study ecology, conservation biology, salmon runs, and forestry. The program is called Ecosystem Management of the Pacific Northwest Indians. Outside their scientific studies, they refuse to be confined to university lecture halls and spend much of their time doing field work, learning from elders. When I heard that, I began to look for a chance to talk to them. In the last 4 years, I have met Native American elders who are the last bridge to the past. They actually knew someone who lived a life of knowledge and wisdom. That memory will be lost when these elders pass away. And here are young Native Americans who are collecting these stories. The other aspect of their work concerns white society and the peculiar science that has been developed by it. How come that white science sees so little beyond the borders of its own paradigms and methods? How come that white science does not learn from its own mistakes? Even the positive aspects of that science that deal with ecology and restoration are clouded by so many failures. How come there are so few examples of successful restoration of a river or a forest? How come that we, as white society, proclaim to love this country while we have no knowledge at all about the way this land was cared for and preserved by Native Americans for thousands of years? And these four young men, I heard, while diligently learning and using some methods of Western science, were asking all these questions. Meanwhile, the wedding feast was eaten, and indeed, one of them agreed to talk to me. We sat on a tree trunk near the last glowing embers of the salmon fire.
My name is Frank Kanawa Dedali Lake, and I'm mixed blood Native American and Mexican American. And my father, he's Karuk, Seneca, and Cherokee and white. And that's where I get my native side. And my mother, she's full-blooded Mexican. I was raised in northwestern California, predominantly in Humboldt County area and the Lower Klamath River and on the coast. And I get most of my cultural and my native, my environmental knowledge and my material culture of being a native person from my dad and my stepfamily. My stepmother, they're Donahue family, and they lived down there in Klamath and Crescent City and grew up fishing with them down at the mouth of the Klamath River. My grandfather on that side is Charlie Tom, and he's Karuk. He lives over in Quartz Valley area, and learned more of the Karuk stuff from him, as well as other elders and native people in the communities.
So some of your family still lived in a traditional way?
Yeah, traditional in a sense. From, you know, we all have electricity and we're not living in plank houses anymore, but we still try to subsist, and at least when I was growing up, collect the herbs for medicinal plant, you know, for medicinal properties, for food, acorns. We hunted, we fished. As far as when things were seasonally available, put the effort into it and make sure the family got together and went and did that. Mm-hmm. And then even with my mom and my stepdad, because my parents were divorced when I was six, they still went out quite a bit and took me, in Trinity County fishing, and we'd go camping and things like that. So I grew up quite a bit outside and being around in the woods.
What do they think of the work you do now?
My Indian side of the family, they're really supportive of it. You know, they see it as kind of what they knew when I grew up, my concern for land and wanting to, heal and restore things and having a real concern about what was going on with the fish and what was going on with the forestry issues and, being a very inquisitive child, I've kind of grown into what I want to be. My mother and my stepfather, they've been also very supportive. They've paid for my education, helped put me through school. I graduated from UC Davis back in 1995 with a degree. And, they've always, both sides of the family have been very supportive. So has the community of Native people that have been pretty receptive to my work and seeing that since it is a community effort about watershed restoration and people being a part of a place for a long haul and being there for generational times, it's been supportive.
So you are learning, you're a grad student, but you're also teaching.
Yes, I enjoy doing the research. When I was back in school through 1990 to 1995 at UC Davis, I was biology and environmental sciences, and a lot of the courses I was taking on the subject of conservation biology or environmental science talked about the standpoint of history and environmental history from like when the Europeans settled it, But there wasn't any credit or really much validity given to Native people and their land management practices and people that lived in place for generations upon generations who had an incredible amount of knowledge about all the natural variations of what happens climatically, predator-prey relationships, fire history, use of fire ecology, but then also, too, the whole range of natural variability from where they lived. And that was never told or talked about in my science classes, that Native people had this knowledge or Indigenous people had this knowledge. So having been raised with that knowledge, I always questioned or, even challenged my professors, a lot of them, about, well, what about our Native people? What about this? I was taught this when I was little, that when you see this bird come back at this time of the year, then you can expect this fish or the whole relationship. The things that they talked about, ecosystem understanding and food web, I grew up with that and inherently understood that and was taught that from our elders and from my family. So, but I didn't see that really being expressed that way from the science.
Not enough impact, right? That's what Western science often says about...
There's two different things. They often say that, that indigenous people in North America were responsible for the Pleistocene extinction of megafauna, like they killed the sloths and the mammoths and all that. But then on the other hand, they said that Native populations were so low, the densities were so low, and they didn't have a very big impact or an effect on the environment. And I think a lot of the biologists didn't have that answer. They weren't taught environmental history. They weren't taught cultural ecology. And a lot of them, first answer is like, well, you should study anthropology or you should study cultural ecology. And I went towards that direction. But what I found is it lacked the more exact scientific methodology of understanding cause and effect relationships, or even going about testing and having a hypothesis to find out the results after an experiment and how you go about that. So I had to work really hard to kind of integrate those together, and what I ended up doing is creating my own major, Integrated Ecology and Culture, with a Native American Studies minor. And the research that I'm doing now as a graduate student up at Oregon State University, I started on my own back when I was in school, because the professors either didn't have the information or they would make assumptions. They're very careful about their own field of work to base it on scientific application and results and facts. But when asked about the Native effect or the historical landscape, they would make assumptions based on no research. And then that would be preached out and taught in the school. And all that would do is further inbred that ideology that Native people had no effect on the landscape, that they didn't manage their landscape, and really took away the rightful entitlement of Native people to place, that they were active managers and that they actually enhanced or maintained the biodiversity that was present in California at the time of settlement by Euro-Americans or Spanish. So I started tackling, and for me it was looking at fisheries management and watershed management and things having to do with rivers and creeks, so the whole kind of aquatic ecology that was really from a cultural management point of view. And what I began to find is that I could learn as much as I could from the Western science that they were teaching me and know and understand that and be trained in that way, but then also come back at them with cultural information that would really show them that they had missing information as far as what their management plans were.
And do you have an example?
Yeah, okay, for example, I like to talk about fish dams and traditional fishing sites. In California, tribal people all up and down the coast subsisted on salmon from about Monterey Bay north. It was the main fishery, all the way far north up to Alaska. And part of that management was a ritualized form of management. So most scientists say, well, that's ritual, you know, that's anecdotal, that's, you know, that's the more the profane, that's the sacred, you know, we don't deal with that, we just deal with methodology. Native people actually managed the sandbars, so they would understand the fish's life history, the predator-prey relationships between the predation from marine mammals like seals and sea lions, or even orcas, killer whales, feeding on the salmon. So they'd open the sandbars, and then what the native people had is a series of either individually owned fishing sites or fish dams, which are basically like big weirs or fences that were created out of like native materials like poles and brush to create these huge structures that went across the dam. And they had them, based on the river geomorphology or how the river valley form is in the gravel bars, had them at different places along the river. And there was coordination up and downstream between tribes about the size of the run of the fish and at how much they would take and when they would harvest. So that was the style. That was in vogue for native people. And they subsisted and harvested a large amount of fish each year for that. And then both they traded out to other tribes who didn't really have fish dams or the mountain tribes.
I heard once that at the beginning of the fish run, they would let like a whole group of fish go through without touching them. Is that true?
That's true. And see, if you get back to the population bell-shaped curve, if you harvested at the beginning of your population, you would hurt the genetic viability of that earlier run because they wouldn't come back earlier the next succeeding generations. So if you let those first fish come back and you harvested at the peak of your bell-shaped curve, right in the middle when the run was the largest, that population of fish or that run or that stock could handle that higher level of harvesting, and then by then you would have enough fish and you would taper off and you wouldn't harvest at the end of that run as much. So the native people had that whole population fisheries management worked out into their fish weirs. So nowadays, you see on the Trinity and the Klamath River, they use fish weirs, iron gates that they put up. They do mark and recapture fish by using these iron fish dams. The same kind of methodology and the same technology. And then historically, Native people had the same way. They would send runners up the riparian trails or along the river. They had trails and over ridges that go into another drainage and coordinate with other villages about the coming of the fish. No different now than, say, a state biologist coordinates with a federal biologist about data and how they're collecting the fish and the timing of the fish coming back up to the headwaters, to either the spawning ground or nowadays the hatchery. So that's one example. The other thing is, if you want to look at fire ecology, Native people use fire extensively for creating prairies, maintaining a diversity of habitat and vegetation, age classes and conditions, and actually accentuated above just physical and biological parameters the different vegetation conditions that were seen on the landscape. Just now, 90 years after Smokey the Bear, because in 1910 the Forest Service had a federal policy of suppressing all wildfires, they're now learning that fire is an integral and healthy part of the environment for both maintaining forest health, age class conditions, and reducing fuel loading that leads to a higher chance of fire severity. So again, they're learning these things all by trial and error and, you know, by basically failed management, whereas if they just would have looked at the indigenous model, what the native people were doing as far as their burning, the timing, how and why they burned, how that affected, say, the avian population of grouse and quail and songbirds and all that, or how it affected the wildlife, like say the deer, the elk, everything on down the line, they would have learned this. But instead what we're doing is they're kind of coming at it through failed attempts. And really, if you look at the status of our environment and the condition of our environment today, we can't, as a biological community, as a social community of people who live in a particular watershed or a place, can't wait for science to come up and learn all this by trial and error. It's time to integrate this traditional knowledge in there and get back to a better management regime in order to preserve it, because most species are going and being quickly listed on the Endangered Species Act. We're seeing restoration attempts fail in many cases. There's just a few success stories on restoration, but not on the broad-scale application that it really needs to, on a geographic, like, you know, whole northern part of the state or the Sierra Nevada range or the Klamath Knot, the Klamath Mountain area. So those are the things that are my examples. And starting from that platform has helped me kind of get my soapbox, get my base, and to say, I'm going to validate our traditional knowledge, our indigenous knowledge, and do it using the scientific tools, their own language, to show them and talk to them and teach them that unless they use this traditional knowledge and integrate it with the Western science, all their attempts most likely are going to have a higher rate of failure.
People at this point can't even imagine what that looked like. The salmon ones that your ancestors saw are nowhere near what's seen today.
How can I tell what the original condition was? Is I listen to my elders, people who still have that living knowledge within the community, because any community, people who live in place for generations have this collective knowledge that accumulates over time. So within our own area, living in the same place, having that same knowledge on the landscape, we collectively have that knowledge to draw back on it so they can say, this is what it looks like. You go out and you play the ecological Sherlock Holmes. But then also then there's the other science part where you can use the ethnographic data or scientific literature to help kind of approximate and get closer to that answer. So although I may, as a living person today, not know what those conditions were like, we can come up with the answers that are all around it that more or less answer it. Or if you want to look at examples, you can go up to like British Columbia or Alaska where they still have good fish runs. There's not as much development or exploitation that has really happened. And you can see how that was. And lo and behold, there's still native populations of people there living and doing, you know, more or less what they want to. I guess, how do I know in a place is I often see the death and destruction of mismanagement. You know, and I use that example of the Black Oaks particularly because there's a lot of places now where you'll walk into a forest stand and you'll see snagged out sugar pines or ponderosa pines that are dead snags, and then you see the Black Oak that's now kind of decadent and on the ground, and then you have all these young fir trees that are up around it. Well, what's happened? You can increment board the trees, you can see how old they are, and you can reconfigure, move back in time, and say, yeah, at one time this was a very vibrant and healthy site that had pine nuts, had big, you know, big thick bark on the firs and the pines and the oaks that would resist fire. And because of the stand condition and the fire ring analysis, what we've done on the fire scars shows that this did have a high fire frequency. Well, look at the natural lightning strike incident. It couldn't have been lightning fire. Oh, well, then down here on the river terrace, only a half mile or a quarter mile away or a mile away, is an old village site. Oh, Indian people were burning. The old people that are still alive on the rancheria, you know, a few miles away, say, yeah, my great-grandmother used to burn that site. That's where we got our acorns, or that's where we got our basket material. So that's how you can get at that picture. But it's disheartening because as a native person and also someone who has to subsist and live off the land, you're going to areas that are impoverished, areas that are, you know, that are on their way to dying or that are really in a state of decay and even kind of chaos sometimes because you look at how things are really going with the exotic species, you know, sometimes with development of areas or toxins. It's really, you know, the whole system's gone through a shock. And when, as a native person, if you're trying to get those things that your material culture or even subsistence, you see that more closely because really your hardware store and your supermarket is out there on that landscape. And when you can't access those places, you yourself lose a part of something that your ancestors had.
You get to talk to your own people and you get to talk to other tribes too about this. How do you go about it?
The first step and the first phase, I guess, is like of my family. Whenever you go into another tribal people's area, you're supposed to come with some form of payment, gifts. Even do a little bit of research and find out what is important to them. Most of California people, they're abalone, pine nut, clam disc money people, you know, they have that kind of regalia and dance items. So if you go to a people's area, you make the payment or you make payment with tobacco or you just go there with some kind of sincere gift or even the thought of saying, I'm here to really learn from you, but also in order to help you, I have to learn what it is that you know and maybe use these other tools that I have from, say, Western science to get at that job. And so that's the first approach, is actually talking to people. And unfortunately, Native people who live in the area have been expressing their views and saying these things and how it's been affecting them for years, for generations. And it's just now, maybe three generations, two generations, one generation removed, that the scientists or people are now starting to take interest in it and go, oh, we should listen to the Native people. So sometimes even when approaching them, because you think you're an outsider, you're going to come in and help, they're disheartened and they're a little tight-lipped about saying things because they've been saying it their whole life and it's fallen on deaf ears. So all of a sudden you come back around, you really have to prove your intent to be meaningful in helping them to get them to share with you that information. And so you can go about it that way. But then also there's a whole host in the library archives of information, like ethnographic information. I use old photographs a lot, photographs that were taken from ethnographers or land surveyors or even early pioneers that depict the landscape under the condition closely or the time closest to that indigenous management by the native people. So I use that to get back at those answers. So then you can take that and go to the native person and an old-timer who's go up there and say, oh, and they'll look at it. And this has happened to me the other day doing my research over in Soames Bar. An elder who lives on that same terrace along the river, when they're like, hey, what the hell are you doing over there, boys? You know, I was breaking around in the brush and trying to get the landscape shots that recreate this photo. And then showing them, he says, oh, this is what it looked like when I was a kid, and he's 70-something years old. So it's like, yeah, this was like that, and this is how it's changed. So you get validation that way, you see, and using that information. And then once you have that, it begins to support the findings of doing the tree ring and the fire scar analysis, the pollen, you know, pollen studies and looking at soil analysis and stuff like that. You begin to use the different forms of information to support maybe what it was like at that time. And understand that there is also, too, variation within that community, but more or less there was these features at these levels and at these kind of areas on the landscape. So that's how you can restoration ecology by doing that.
I think this is a really important time because the last people who still have connections to the people who saw it are now elders. So the living knowledge is sort of just about to go with those people who are now old. And you all going around and talking to people is really important.
See, that's the dilemma for me, is because should I be spending time back down on a river, fishing with these elders, going out there hunting with them, going out there with them to collect their medicinal herbs for they can take care of their diabetes or take care of this other health ailment? Or do I go to school and sit in front of a professor who knows maybe scientific information about it, who talks generally about it and may have the in-depth information and the most up-to-date information there, but only to find that in my two semesters or my time away at school, that elder passed away, you see? And you can go back and get certain things out of books, but it's a lot different when you're there with the elder and they're walking you out and telling you this, or they're sitting there kind of growling around at you and really, you know, making sure you listen and really kind of more or less reprimanding you in a positive, supportive way to make sure you learn it right.
What did you pick?
Well, a little bit of both. So what I'm able to do is, fortunately, and that's the only reason why I've gone back to school, was that my terms and conditions were, is I get full funding, I'm able to research what I want to, that puts me for, you know, a good part of the time in my summer field work back down in my community with trips to come back in the winter. So I'm finding a kind of, hopefully, a happy medium between both. And for the most part, I've spent a good deal of my summer back down here along the river, the Lower Klamath, fishing and hunting and going out with the basket weavers and visiting with the elders and, you know, cooking fish like I did here today, maintaining that culture, because the only way you maintain culture is by living it. There's a lot of information in a book, but it is no good up on the shelf unless you can walk out there and actually do it. You can bust down off the side of the hill and go to the river and show what you use for this material for old-time string, or what, you know, the right morphological structure of this stem should be for the right type of basket or that kind of basket, or what kind of bark you use for this medicine. You know, you have to use it. It's one thing to read it in a book. It's another thing to actually treat your ailment or feed yourself with the knowledge you know.
So have you actually been doing active restoration work?
Right now, I'm more at the research phase. But you see, restoration is at different levels. Sometimes people think you have to be running the excavator and pulling back a road. But what about the 12-year-old boy that I take out and show how to make, you know, his traditional gambling sticks? I teach him a song. I take him to the elder who knows something, or share with them what I know. See, so restoration for me happens both physically, biologically, and also culturally. So I try to run around and do all three, because without one or the other, each one's going to suffer.
So you work with kids?
Yeah, and
tell me about that.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service funded to the Yurok, Kupaw, Karuk, and actually the Klamath tribes money for what we call a salmon camp. And it's between 4 to 6 native youth from each tribe, and they spend 2 weeks on the Klamath and Trinity River, and they go from the headwaters all the way down to the mouth and all the way back up to the Trinity, and they basically look at all watershed restoration, irrigation issues and water diversion projects. They talk with irrigation and landowners up in the Wairika area and on the Scott and Shasta River. They talk to, you know, sometimes they even get to meet with the miners, people doing dredging and things on the Klamath and Trinity. They get to go on raft trips and talk to the guides and the boating service and see how important recreational use is. Sport fishermen, tribal fishermen, the scientists who work both for tribal agencies or the state or federal agencies for restoration. So during those 2 weeks, we camp out at different places for a couple of days at a time and review restoration projects, review fish monitoring projects, take them snorkeling, take them on raft trips, take them fishing, and give them a big comprehensive overview of the watershed and how it affects them economically, you know, culturally and environmentally. So, and I hope to see in the future that we can continue that, because even if it's just, say, 15 or 16 students that are ages 14 to 18, if you can reach a few of them, those are going to be our future biologists, our future people who either work for the tribe or the government agencies who come with them, their traditional knowledge, but also the Western education to help back up and support the work that they're doing. And particularly, as we know in, you know, our rural areas in Northern California or anywhere in the Pacific Northwest, is that it's vital to have your local knowledge plus have the degrees or the training to come back home and bring that knowledge back home from getting an education outside.
That was Frank Kanawha Lake, recorded at an Indian wedding in the Trinity Alps in late August of 2000. He told me that he is mixed-blood Native American and Mexican-American. On his father's side, he's Karuk, Seneca, and Cherokee. He was raised in a traditional way on the Lower Klamath River and on the coast of Northern California. He studied conservation biology at UC Davis and is now teaching at the University of Oregon Corvallis while doing a major on integrated ecology and culture. He and his three friends are the vanguard of a new generation of young Native American scientists who bring traditional knowledge to Western science. TUC Radio would like to maintain the connection to Frank Kanawha Lake and his colleagues and get the word out about this work. We hope that we, who arrived here recently, may learn to see this land with new old eyes and be inspired to protect it. Please contact us if you want to support programs such as the one you just heard. For your gift of support, we will send you a copy of this tape. Call us anytime, toll-free, at 1-877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. Be sure to give your phone number, because we want to talk to you. You can also write to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. My name is Mariah Gillardin. Thank you for listening.